okay, you can figure it out with something that is even more sacred than insurance. Kumar?
I think Mariella will start off.
Yes, thank you very much. Good afternoon to everybody. The purpose of this meeting is to talk about macro hedging and specifically to gather your views and your input on the discussion paper that we just published last April on dynamic risk management. And to do this, we have selected a number of areas that we consider that are key for the purposes of representing the discussion paper and for our discussion. And along with those key areas, we have questions for you to provide feedback to us. But we are also open for you to ask any questions at any time. And if you do have any questions right now on the discussion paper that would not necessarily follow or fall into the key areas that we will be discussing later on, then please feel free and we'll try to answer to your questions. If you don't have any specific questions right now, we could then kick off the meeting and start with the slides.
Okay, continue.
Right. Probably we will be then having more discussions then as the slides go on. So, as you know, the ISB is exploring an approach to better reflect an entity's dynamic risk management activities in the financial statements. And also, the project aims to reduce the operational complexities that entities face when trying to represent dynamic risk management activities using the current hedge accounting requirements. The first topic that we would like to tackle is in slide 3, and this deals with the core of the discussion paper, dynamic risk management. And the discussion paper does not define dynamic risk management. It describes dynamic risk management as a continuous process because the risk management is being done to items that change continuously. Those are open portfolios. New exposures come in. All exposures expire and are withdrawn. And as a result of this, then risk management has to adapt and has to change continuously. And as said before, the current hedge accounting requirements do not deal very well with such an environment, such a dynamic environment. But we would like to assess the need for an accounting approach that would better reflect those activities. And the first question for you is whether you think there is a need for a specific accounting approach to represent dynamic risk management activities in entities' financial statements. And why or why not as well?
Linda?
Thanks. So we did a fair amount of outreach on this, and I think, Mariella, you were able to listen in to our User Advisory Council meeting on this topic. We also spoke to some of the larger accounting firms in Canada, FEI, Canadian Council on Corporate Reporting. We did talk to our insurance task force about this issue, in addition to our User Advisory Council. So taking all that into consideration, the sum total, I think the question you're asking here, you know, you think there's a need for a specific accounting approach is almost like you almost take it immediately to this, what the scope would be. What would be the scope of this type of project, because that's the way people are talking about it. And the first reaction we got from people was, they were having some difficulty thinking about it initially because the nature of the discussion paper is very much from a financial institution perspective. So that being the case, you know, when we probed a little more, in the Canadian context, the first thing that came to mind was potential commodity companies. And so actually we have an undertaking from FEI that they are going to try to focus on talking to some of their members who are in commodity companies and seeing if they can do some work on this in terms of potential scoping, et cetera. They all agree that they do risk management. They all agree that they have a formal approach to risk management. And they all agree that the current hedge accounting model doesn't meet their needs. So one would indicate that if you tick all those boxes, it's likely that they want to do some more work in terms of, you know, kind of the methodology that the discussion paper might be might be understanding. When we talk to our user advisory council in particular, I think it's fair to say that people have different levels of understanding of current hedge accounting and how it's reported in current financial statements. They seem to resonate with the notion, and Marielle, you got this information firsthand, but my big takeaway from that discussion, they seem to take away the notion that this would be something that while large sophisticated financial institutions deal with the current hedge accounting quite well because they've either implemented systems, whatever. So they deal with the open or closed portfolio by simply de-designating and redesignating on a very, very, very frequent basis. The sense that the users got was that they thought that all institutions or all companies could consider what they try to do today around non-accounting hedges, in other words, hedges, economic hedges that don't meet the accounting requirements today, that they might explore that more fully by looking at macro hedging as an opportunity. The specific comments of the Insurance Accounting Task Force related to, again, participating contracts. So we've already mentioned that already. They seem to be interested in that. I mean, insurers basically said we do two things. We issue insurance contracts, and we do very, very active asset liability management. And so to the extent that the current hedge accounting model doesn't meet their needs, they probably would pursue something in terms of what you're describing here in terms of macro hedging. I think that's the gist of the main comments that we receive from our outreach. I think the other one thing that the firms gave back to us is they find the name confusing. And so they find the name of the discussion paper confusing. Mm-hmm. So
what should the name be?
Well, it's interesting because you're saying it's dynamic risk management, and that's what you're trying to hone in on, is do you have a dynamic risk management thing that you do, and could this apply? But it seems to, I think they may be confusing the confusion with the name versus the examples that are largely focused on financial institutions. But it was a comment that I agreed to pass along.
Okay.
Yeah, first of all, it's a much welcome paper. I believe it has the potential to solve many of the problems and the idiosyncrasies that are present today because of IAS 39 approach. Going straight into the question one, assessing the need for an approach, I strongly believe that you need to, first of all, define better what dynamic risk management is. Why? Because the fact that you have assets and liabilities and open portfolios related to a specific kind of risk, like interest rate risk, doesn't necessarily mean that you have a dynamic risk management process. And what's necessary to characterize a specific company as having a dynamic risk management phenomenon in place? Because otherwise you can create opportunistic behavior, say, well, now I have a dynamic risk management approach, and then I do not have. What's necessary in terms of documentation? Sorry for being a little bit bureaucratic, but companies that have a dynamic risk management in place, they have the structure around it, because it's not something that you decide to do in the morning. Well, it's something that is embedded in the risk management policy, etc. So, for me, I was a little bit uncomfortable. I like the concept, but I believe that it must be better defined and in actual terms.
So basically what you're telling us is that you think there is a need for
a solution
which is coming up for that.
Yeah.
Linda, just picking up, did you get any feedback from the banks and others? Do you think they have the systems and they are matching, actually, they're doing it?
Yeah, so sure. I mean, I think the gist of their comments were that they already deal with operational complexity and they're quite good at it. So they would be looking at this more from the standpoint of there are things today that they can't achieve that they might be able to achieve, as opposed to, for instance, you know, they have this notion where they manage interest rate risk by, you know, taking the portfolios and redesignating them very quickly. In some cases, they do it every day, okay? So they take what is so-called closed portfolio, they open it up, and then just redesignate another hedge accounting relationship every single day. They don't care about that. They're happy with that. They know how to do it. It's embedded in their systems. It's embedded in the way they do transfer pricing amongst different pieces of the bank. Like they basically say, we're not sure we'd open that up for something new without taking a very close look at it. What they're trying to actually explore right now is whether there's other cases where right now they might use the notion of an economic hedge, and would they be able to actually get better results by applying this?
I have to acknowledge here that I'm using a little bit of my experience as I work in a bank. Mm-hmm. And this process that she mentions, it really happens all the time. So it's extremely expensive to designate and redesignate. And it doesn't mean really, you cannot have, designate and redesignate hedges three times a week. So it doesn't, that's what end up happening. So the situation mm-hmm. today is quite distant from the economic reality. So
but
I think
says it's no problem. automated.
I don't like it because.
But for control reasons, for internal control reasons, most of the banks in the big banks in Canada have put in very sophisticated hedge accounting systems, and they just motor through this, and so they're less concerned about this as something that would be a solution for that situation, Hans, because they've done it.
I understand the point is not a problem because we are accommodated to a bad solution. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We are already accommodated. There is a sunk cost here and accommodated. But I don't believe it is a sound solution.
Well, that's what you say.
To keep changing.
The reduction of the discussion.
Yeah.
Hazel.
In a way, I could resonate what you said before. Some are very reluctant. They read this paper and think fine. However, they've arranged themselves with the current accounting, and before they jump to something else, they think they need to have a much closer look before they invest in something else. And the financial services is one thing, presumably including insurance companies. Mm-hmm. With the utilities, they seem to have found ways of whatever they wanted to do, and their imagination maybe hasn't gone that far yet that they might be offered something they haven't had so far. And maybe the bottom line for all of them is risk management is one thing and accounting is something else. And in a way, to equate risk management and accounting on a two straight line, this is, who would be the winner of it? So far, we've always had restrictions in accounting. We've had assets, we've had liabilities, we have not had net positions on the asset or liability side, and so people are hesitant to see what it will be once we depict something different. And as long as we're stuck with assets and liabilities, there probably is a limit what we can do in really depicting the risk management. And maybe the objective stated, I underlined specifically as Mariella sort of seemed to point to those words, to better reflect, not necessarily on a one-to-one basis. And people are sometimes maybe a bit more reluctant to hope for a lot of room for maneuver. And so they are watching it with interest, but not that much enthusiasm yet.
Thank you.
After the discussion paper was issued last month, we had preliminary discussions with our constituent in Japan, including users, preparers, and auditors, who all have the expertise in accounting for financial instrument. Due to the complexity of the subject, we are still struggling with understanding what exactly the DC is proposing. Therefore, please acknowledge that what I'm saying here is preliminary and is subject to change in our future discussions. But let me start with the reason why we have been struggling. The DP explains that there are two objectives of this project, which are to faithfully represent dynamic risk management and to reduce operational complexity of hedge accounting for open portfolios. So we think that these two objectives are competing with each other and would likely result in different conclusions on each question. Accordingly, at the outset, it is critical that the ISB make clear about which objective is prioritized. For example, if we were to emphasize faithful representation of dynamic risk management of an entity, the ISB is likely to conclude that we should require the proposed approach to all portfolios with interest rate risk. On the other hand, if we were to emphasize reduction of operational complexity of hedge accounting for open portfolios, the ISB is likely to conclude that we should permit the proposed approach for limited portfolios within the entity.
First of all, China, we support the DP that there is a need for a special accounting approach for the macro hedging. We also did some investigation in China whether there are any practice of macro hedging there. By now, it seems that for banks, we have not yet found any banks are using macro hedging to hedge interest risks and other risks. But for commodity companies, it seems that they do have those similar macro hedging strategies. Some companies, such as copper product companies, they will in the future they will buy some coppers and also sell them coppers. They're using they try to using strategies, try to buy some commodity futures to hedge the changes in prices of the commodities to based on the open portfolio and net position. Mm-hmm. So for those companies, they do need a macro hedging accounting requirements because under the current general hedging accounting standards, it's difficult for them to apply. But if they use the macro hedging requirement, maybe they can find a solution to try to account for the transaction based on their risk management practice. But the one thing, because according to the current discussion paper, it is actually based on the banks, and almost all of the examples are based on the interest risk management. So we're still thinking about how to apply the principle for those commodity companies. We hope that in the future the ISB could provide more guidance for those companies.
Thanks, Hans. Yeah, when Linda mentioned that there were some concerns around the title, it is interesting that colloquially people talk about this as being macro hedging, but specifically it's described as dynamic risk management. So I guess I'd like to echo the points that Yukio raised in terms of saying, well, is it really to reflect the accounting mismatches created because people have actually entered into economic hedges, or does it actually reflect effectively the risks that the entity has chosen not to hedge economically? And I guess that for me is the question. So if you look at, and that's going to come down to the scoping, but if you've got a situation where you are exposed to interest rate risk because you've got fixed interest rate instruments, but you decide economically that you only want to economically hedge 30%. My understanding of the proposal is that I'll get my nice offset on that 30%, but I would now be reflecting that fair value exposure on the 70%.
Under one particular scope alternative, depending upon which view you take.
Correct. So that's why the question says, should there be an accounting standard on dynamic risk management? The question is, are we trying to reflect entities' risk management processes? And maybe they decide that they're quite happy to be exposed and they make the decision not to enter into economic hedges. Are we trying to reflect that? Is that really the intention? Or is the intention, as everybody sort of more refers to the macro hedging, that we you know, because they've entered into instruments which need to be at fair value, we've got this accounting mismatch that we need to try and fix. So I think initially when we had some discussions with the banking industry, I think they were concerned about now having to perhaps fair value exposures, and I know it's not true fair value, but effectively reflecting the impact of, you know, exposure to interest rate risk on the things that they had chosen not to hedge economically. So I think really the board's got to think carefully about, well, you know, what are, you know.
Correct.
Because otherwise the point would be basically it's almost like going back to just a fair value model of saying, well, if you're exposed to a risk, you need to reflect that exposure. If you've economically hedged it, you then get the offset, but if you haven't, you will see that exposure. Whereas normally with a fixed rate instrument, you're going to collect the contractual cash flows or pay the contractual cash flows, you don't show the change in market interest rate.
But I agree, so Kim. That is more the scope question.
Correct, and I think coming out from some of the comments, some people are seeing it purely as a macro hedging thing, but to me, I think the board is specifically has gone wider, and I think that really is something which needs to be looked at carefully.
I'd probably reiterate the comments that Kim and Linda made about the title, and I think accounting for dynamic risk management is sort of one thing, macro hedge accounting implies something else. And when I was reading the discussion paper, I was sort of flip-flopping between what I was thinking about, and on the one hand, I was very much thinking about operational challenges that banks have, and much of the discussion paper is focused on all of those challenges that we know the stump of IS 39 is we're trying to think, how do we improve that so that we can move on to have a complete financial instrument standard in 9. And I think that's sort of one thinking process, and it's trying to say, well, is there a better approach rather than doing the constant designation, de-designation, amortization of the fair value hedge adjustment, which we know is a huge exercise for all of the banks that choose to do that to get the accounting that they think best represents the economics, so essentially taking out derivative volatility. So I think that's the first thing that the discussion paper is thinking about, and very much financial instruments focused. The next thing that it moves on to is then, if we take this perhaps more simplified approach, what else could that lead us on to? And I almost think it takes us out of the world of financial instruments into potentially everything else in the scope of accounting. And that's where I sort of blow up into thinking about the conceptual framework, and am I actually thinking about solving more of a measurement issue rather than simply financial instruments dynamic risk management? We've talked a little bit about what else this approach could have application to. One of the areas would be insurance contracts. Other areas, Kevin and I talked about, what about defined benefit liabilities and the interest rate risk in defined benefit liabilities. There's nothing in the discussion paper that talks about that, but if we're opening the scope up to what risks could we think about and what other scenarios that we're looking at, then is that something we ought to think about as well? So I think maybe that scope is too broad, but maybe we need to focus back in on what could be achieved in the discussion paper towards getting an exposure draft out, and perhaps that is seeking a solution to the operational challenges in 39, and then perhaps as a second stream to have a look at, well, what are the learnings from that approach, whether it gets off the ground or not, but what is the thinking that we do in that process, and then could we apply that to other scenarios, and are we actually looking for problems that may or may not exist? For most jurisdictions, IFRS 9 hedge accounting is not yet available, or is very much in the initial phases of people thinking about what can they now do that they couldn't do before.
So are there some of the scenarios will be dealt with by what will be available now, such that the portfolio revaluation approach may not be needed, or after that has been applied in its sort of fullest extent, are there still problems that we think, whether dynamic or not, this could be an approach that actually improves accounting? And I would question whether dynamic or not dynamic is necessarily the right criteria, because if we think we get good accounting from the approach, why is it necessarily limited to just dynamic scenarios?
Just to reiterate, so basically what you're saying, if I got that right, so is that effectively it would be, you're not sure as whether there is an immediate need for such an approach right now, but what you're considering is look at how IFRS 9 comes into play and what solutions people that have with IAS 39 can do with that, and then consider whether this approach is needed.
Yeah, outside of the banking situation that we know about. So definitely I think that's worth looking at. There's certainly appetite in the Australian banks to see is there something that can be done in the short term to make the process easier to operationalise. Then I think that is probably something that can be achieved in the shorter term. Then in the longer term, if this approach is robust, and whether it's an entire exposure or it's just based on what is mitigated, could that have a wider application?
Mike?
Thanks. I'm probably going to echo some of the comments that have been made already, but I do think the board should be congratulated for at least taking the initiative to do some new thinking around this area. And I slightly disagree with the sort of concept that everything's okay with IAS 39 and just keep going, because not only do I think there are severe operational difficulties with it, but actually I don't think it's a good portrayal of what actually happens. I mean, most banks spend their lives doing the risk management they do, and then desperately hunting for assets and liabilities against which to do the accounting, which are invariably not the ones that they had in mind when they did the risk management in the first place. So, you know, in some ways it's perverse, let alone anything else. So I do think that some fresh thinking is to be commended. I do have a concern that you've taken it wider than it needs to be, because fundamentally at the end of the day, why do you need some form of accounting around this sort of process? It's because we have a mismatched accounting model. We have some stuff at fair value and we have some stuff at amortized cost. You know, if all derivatives were at amortized cost, you wouldn't have a problem. Well, you'd have a different problem. So I think there is a danger you're taking it too wide. I'd also say that one of the other traps that I think you need to be careful not to fall into is this idea that somehow you more accurately portray the risk faced by an organisation if you fair value it. You don't. All you show is what the value is at a point in time. It could be zero, depending upon what the assumptions are that are in the fair value at that point in time. So if you want to portray the risk, that's done by other means, by notes, by expanding what is the profile going out, because then people understand what happens as that fair value changes, whether you fair value it or whether you use amortized cost. It's neither here nor there in terms of demonstrating what the risk is that's being faced by the organisation. So I think it's worth looking at. I'm not convinced this is the model, and I think it, as I say, it goes wider than it needs to. But again, early stages of us looking at it.
Clement?
Yeah. As a general comment, I think not much sort of enthusiasm apart from banks and financial institutions on the discussion paper. Right now, our views in the region is quite mixed. Some members are not really, you know, sort of are having a concern on the proposed portfolio revaluation approach, because they are having doubt whether it really reflects the complexity of risk management carried out by financial institutions, particularly, you know, in the aspect that the present paper just look at one given risk in isolation, and but the others are having a more sort of relaxed view, saying that it's a worthwhile project to explore further. Well, I think the question that will follow will be does the board or this does the group is having a intention that this DP is going to stop people to think about hedging for more than one type of risk rather than, you know, just the type the interest rate risk that you're looking at right now?
Roger?
Well, I think it's interesting talking about the title of this. Of course, risk management doesn't necessarily mean say reducing risks. It can mean increasing risk, or in banks' case, it certainly can be changing the shape of the curve without necessarily reducing risk. Now, banks and hedging problem, macro hedging problems stem from some constraints in IFRS. So you can't look at behavior. Looking at the length of deposits, you can only look at the contractual constraints. And this paper more or less does away with all those constraints. So it does away with behavior as a constraint, but it then ends up with quite a radical solution. Now, I think the paper is very good, and I commend the people who've written the paper, but I think it would be nice to see an alternative which actually looked at more normal hedging, but without those various constraints, which we've abandoned in getting to the solution in this paper. And I think that would be perhaps more what people were looking for out of this project. So I think it would be nice to see a plan B, which is how would hedging look like if you were to abandon the various constraints which make hedging so difficult for the banks at the moment, but we're still a hedging model. I do agree with Mike that I think ending up with a fair value of a risk, particularly if it's only a risk in a portfolio you've decided to do some dynamic hedging against, doesn't necessarily very well portray the risk, particularly in what's otherwise a cost accounting model of a bank loan and deposit model. So I do think it's very interesting work, but I would like to see an alternative which was nearer to normal hedging.
But trying to address constraints, isn't that what we try to do with the general hedging model that we just improved?
Yes, but it still has those various problems that you're going to have a macro hedging, like looking at behavior, for example.
So if I can, Roger, what you're thinking about is instead of looking at a completely new aspect, which the paper does, take the existing models and see if you can tweak the constraints in that.
Well, if you were to release all of the constraints that you've released in this new model, I think you deal away with many of the problems the banks have in applying macro hedging.
The existing macro hedging model will also start coming closer to what we have put in this paper as well.
But you're still hedging the risk that banks have decided to hedge rather than trying to set up a fair value of the risk.
The current value which we look at, yes, in one of the scope alternatives. The paper does consider the other alternative as well, where you look at where you have done hedging instead of everything.
But you still end up, in Kim's example, if you've only hedged 70% of the risk, you still end up fair valuing the other 70%.
In only one of the proposed alternatives, not there is another alternative in there where you look at matching the current values of only that 30%, depending upon what
you've done. In which case you'd end up with that.
Of course, in their internal risk management, the bank will always be looking at the 70% and the risk embedded in the 30%, and they will look much further than amortized cost. It's just they don't want to.
But the problem
show it in the accounts, but that's what they're looking
for. But the bank's problem really is that because they can't get hedge accounting, they have these financial instruments producing effects in a period other than the economic, the period where economically they're hedged. That's their problem. Their problem isn't that they particularly want to fair value the 30% or the 100%. The problem is that they have these financial instruments producing gains and losses in this period, not in the period in which they're trying to hedge. So that's the problem they're trying to solve.
Russ?
So I agree with Kim's point. This is going to be a very interesting choice that you'll have to make as to whether or not this project should be about showing when risk is not mitigated versus showing when you've mitigated a subset of the risk. The question about do you think there's a need for a specific accounting approach is very difficult for me to answer, because in the U.S. we need a new and improved hedging model. It's very complicated. As you know, you've gone ahead and had the courage to make an improvement. It'll be interesting to see does that improvement that you made mitigate some of the need for this. But I've got a couple of observations, we'll get more questions, but one of which was not a question, has to do with the auditability. Because this is so heavily dependent upon management's intent, and management intent is very difficult to audit, and oftentimes you go back and look at past history, and you create caning, and you create the concern. I would encourage you, if you move down the approach, whether it's all risk or just the risk that is mitigated, to work closely with the auditing profession to see how they will actually implement it from an auditing perspective, because it's management intent, it's very difficult to audit.
Just a brief note on practitioners' opinion about this thing here, because I believe they tend to be biased in two directions. I believe they tend to minimize the problems with IAS 39 just because it's an incurred cost. You know what I mean? It's already there. And you know, a good rule is an old rule, because people are used to it. You know? They're already familiar, et cetera. So I would be cautious about that. And the second one is, I believe the big problem today is that economic hedges, which are not treated as accounting hedges. In that sense, if you try to flexibilize IAS 39, it will increase the number of the amount of economic hedges that could be treated as accounting hedges. But I do not believe that solves the problem conceptually. So my point is, I believe that you should stick to your point to solve the problem conceptually and not try to accommodate under IAS 39. So I would go for a new model, and this point that Russ made about auditability is that that's why I believe you need one of the reasons I believe you need a better definition of risk management, because it must be auditable at the end of the day. It's not easy.
Yeah, just wanted to make one point. I appreciate that. The two views, and we are looking at, Kim, as you said, 30% is one of the options in the DP. The other is to look at the entire portfolio, because for the board, when they were considering this, when they were considering a new model, was to try and capture what banks do in their risk management, not specifically hedging. So that is one of the streams that of thought that's explored. And if you are managing something dynamically, then that's one way of capturing it. I'm not saying that's the only way, so that's the reason why it's there in the DP. The other is closer to a hedging model with some, as Roger says, with some of the tweaks and other things removed. But the second alternative also brings in that you must realize that then there's on-off designation, de-designation, and all of these issues do come up. So that's one of the reasons why both of these were explored. And what we are hearing, we seem to be hearing generally, is that it's what people are considering is looking for a solution to the problems of the mismatch.
Okay, no other comments, contributions, none? Okay, thank you very much.
I thought we were just answering question one.
Nice try.
Too optimistic.
All right, well, the next couple of slides try to frame the next three questions that we have from 2 to 4. I'll be very quick, as quick as my English allows.
We have all the time.
I can swap into Spanish, it would be quicker. okay, so the first slide portrays how the mechanics of the portfolio revaluation approach would work. And basically in here, an entity applying the portfolio revaluation approach would revalue the exposures included in open portfolios only for the managed risk. And that managed risk is the green portion of those cash flows that you see from assets and liabilities. And that revaluation will be offset by the changes in fair value of the derivatives, which is the red square at the bottom. And this is to emphasize that this is not a full fair value model, because not all of the risks are being revalued if they are not being dynamically managed. And the next slide summarizes very, very briefly what are the improvements that are expected from this approach. And it basically summarizes what are the features of dynamic risk management and how those features of dynamic risk management, what are the difficulties of this to portray those features using the hedge accounting requirements that we have today. So basically, the portfolio revaluation approach would enhance information about dynamic risk management activities,
It would reduce complexities, operational complexities such as tracking of hedge accounting relationships and amortizations of hedge adjustments. Dynamic risk management is done on a net basis, and this would be captured by the approach. Dynamic risk management focuses more on behavioral features rather than contractual features, and this is precisely what the approach would consider. And it would also consider different types of risks. Having said all this, then the first question, question two, that we have in slide six is about behavioralization. So whether for the purposes of applying the approach, the cash flows of those exposures should be based on a behavioral rather than on a contractual basis when that risk is managed on a behavioral basis.
Lastly, I suppose this is where your comment on auditability came in, right?
I think it's a tough. I think you have to, in order to go with your model, you have to do it on behavioral.
Yeah.
But I think that makes it very hard to audit.
Yeah. It's also what, you know, I think is the most vulnerable part of the
quite quick here.
The same thing.
And
the
same with court. Yeah.
I don't know how you exclude court deposits, but yeah. Makes it hard.
Makes it very hard.
Mine is quite quick here. I think you have to answer yes to question two and three, otherwise you don't have the project.
Yeah.
I believe it. If I answer no here, and I cannot use a behavior approach to, I don't have dynamic.
Yeah, questions
two
and three are related. Yeah.
Don't see how I can answer no.
Mike.
Well, I'm going to be first, but I'm going to answer question four first, which is I don't think it does. Because I think the whole problem with this model is it makes an implicit assumption that the purpose behind this risk management is to manage fair value risk. And frankly, I don't think that's true for most of the banks that I've come across. What they're seeking to do in most cases is to try and get some stability to their net interest income over a period of time. You can't get it totally because you don't know what interest rates are going to be doing in 20 years' time, but they try and smooth that effect.
Yeah.
So I think if you accept that, then you then have to do something around behavioralization and core demand deposits. I agree with the question around auditability, and frankly, you can't pin this down. There is no science to that behavioralization that is auditable. The only thing you can do with that is to get people to say what it is they are doing, what behavioral assumptions they are making, and for the market to judge whether they like those or not. I don't think there's another way around that. But I do think that you've got to go back and look at the model approach afresh anyway, because as I say, I just think it starts from the wrong basis. It is not what banks seek to do, is to manage fair value risk in their portfolios.
It's to manage part of a full fair value risk.
No, it isn't.
To manage their interest rate risk.
No, but not from a fair value perspective. What they're seeking to do is to stabilize net interest income, and the two things are fundamentally very different.
How so?
Because all I'm seeking to do, for example, in trying to stabilize my net interest income is to have a smooth net interest income over time.
Yeah.
So, for example, I will have an interest rate profile which allows me to have a rolling five-year program of five-year fixed rates. So 1 year drops off, then you add 1 year on, but it flows down the road. That's not looking to preserve fair value. That's looking to stabilize net interest. If I wanted to preserve if I wanted to take out my exposure to fair value movements, I'd do it all short term. I don't do that. I don't want to do that. Even with the behavioralization aspect, that's not what I'm seeking to achieve. I'm seeking to actually get stability in my net interest income as I portray it to the investors. And the reason I do it is because, frankly, investors like that.
And also
the fact you don't play at the short end of the yield curve because you don't make any money. So you've got to be able to extend your interest rate profile out. And these days, people will do it through derivatives.
Yeah, he's right. That's right.
That's the way it works. So fundamentally, the model is not getting at what people do. That's my concern with it.
I agree with you, Mike. Just one side is that some of the things what we have discussed before is we are looking at some could take a cash flow view because they are trying to stabilize cash flow. But I think where I would also like to come in is that some banks do it, and we have heard that. Not all. And you had meat.
Not the majority, as far as I'm concerned.
That's where I will beg to disagree with you. But majority, I don't know. But I think on the very first day, you had made the statement that we will try and please some and not the others. So this is one of the ways bank look at it, and that's what we will have a discussion on day after, I think.
Yeah.
I do agree. So then what would you say would be a good way of looking at it? Because there's a cash flow model which is there, but the fair value or the current measurement which we do, which is not a fair value, tries to capture at that point in time what the position is, and there's a way of capturing it. What would be another alternative to consider?
Well, if you think about it, what you're trying to do within this model, and you achieve it in a very complex and convoluted fashion, is you are protecting the income account from movements in fair value. You're effectively allowing accruals accounting in the income account. You just don't call it that.
And to do, but okay, coming back to the questions two and three, but to do either of this, whichever way we go through number four, we'll
have to
do
build those bits in. Yes, I agree with you, but I wanted to start with question four because the answer is I wouldn't want to answer yes to those two and think, oh, well, that means the model's work. No, it isn't, because I don't think the model's starting in the right place. I think invariably you have to do something around core deposits and behavioralization. As I say, I agree with the point on auditability, and I don't think there's a science behind behavioralization. I think you've got to get people to be explicit about the assumptions they're making.
Sue?
Just wanted to talk about the managed risk part of it, because I think the obvious example is managing interest rate risk using derivatives, and then the problem in accounting is the volatility from the derivative, so we're seeking some way to offset or take that out of the P&L. I think to say that because you have a derivative, you're managing it, yes, that's true, but you're also doing other things to manage other risks. So, for example, credit risk is not necessarily managed using credit derivatives. There's other processes in place. So that is managed, but we're not necessarily saying, well, we're going to remeasure for credit risk movement in this process. So the question about whether it's elective because I'm managing using derivatives, or is it that I'm managing using any process, and do I want to be able to pick and choose how I manage the risks as to whether I'm in or out of this approach, and that sort of componentization of accounting based on the risk mitigation process seems somewhat arbitrary. But if you go down the thinking of saying, well, actually, I'm managing all of the risks, which is probably the case, then that's probably putting me into a full fair value approach. I think that really highlights that we're coming at it from an accounting problem and working backwards rather than from an underlying economics approach, thinking how do we best represent what's really happening with the underlying items.
So your concern, Sue, is that if we extend it for other risks, that's where why are we choosing arbitrarily the interest rate risk?
Well, I think it's just really being explicit about the fact that this is an accounting solution to a problem arising with the mixed measurement from having items at amortized cost and items at fair value.
That in the beginning of the discussion paper.
But then we're saying it's based on managed risk, but we don't then say, well, there's other other risk management, but we don't have a problem with that because we don't bring that to account already. But we should acknowledge that that is a managed risk and that is not being accounted for.
Agreed, but not credit risk, from the best what we know, is not managed like this dynamically. Normally, banks will not manage the credit portfolio in an open. They will do it on a net basis, indeed, but not on a dynamic basis. So from a bank's perspective, and again, that can change from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and what is it? Credit risk is not something that's continuously being measured, managed on a dynamic basis. So I agree. The question is, what is the trigger for this remeasurement?
Yeah, and is the fact that it is or it isn't dynamically risk managed a good rationale for why we do or don't account for something?
Agreed, but we do have hedge accounting, which just fair value hedging, which triggers in because you have a derivative and that's what you're doing. So this is another rationale for triggering in a different thing.
It is, but in that we don't say it's the managed risk. We're specifically designating what we want to hedge. I think this approach, it almost, it implies that you are accounting for the managed risk, but it's still an elective
so
managed risk.
Here means dynamically managed risk. So, as we have not yet defined what is dynamic risk management, yeah, this is the fundamental concern some of you have raised today. But so one of the main features of dynamic risk management, you are based on open portfolios. So as far as, to the best of our knowledge, the candidates of dynamically managed risk are interest rate risk and FX risk and commodity price risk. We are sure that they could be managed dynamically. But do you think credit risk is managed dynamically based on open portfolios?
I haven't heard that.
Are you really raising that? Why is it that some managed risk, why is only dynamic managed risk in it? Why not all managed risk? I think you're raising the point. I think you're exactly right. The dynamic is interest, commodities, and currencies. But I think Sue's point, there's other things that are managed risks that aren't managed with derivatives, and so why would they be in or out?
So I think the dynamic part of it means there's operational challenges. And so therefore we're looking for a solution. But if we take away the operational challenge from dynamic, then why should non-dynamic managed risks be treated differently?
No, I think, agree. For non-dynamic, we haven't looked at it, but you have Nine and other hedge accounting solutions there which take care of it. So one of the things which we're trying to do is, agreed, comes from a problem, but looking at a wider perspective when you do that is not just looking at hedge accounting, but also looking at what are the solutions and how do we better represent it or capture it in the financial statements. And agreed, maybe that's where the confusion comes from. But the purpose was not just to look at that, because then we wouldn't be having scope alternative A.
For question two and three, if we were to apply the portfolio risk approach, we agree that the cash flows should be based on the behavioralized basis, including core demand deposit. This is because two objectives cannot be fulfilled if we were to stick to following contractual terms. However, we encounter with a significant degree of estimation uncertainty. If we were to factor in such behavioralized patterns, and some preparers and auditors expressed a concern about the lack of objectivity. So accordingly, we need to consider whether such heightened estimation uncertainties can be sufficiently justified with the increased relevance of financial information when assessing whether the proposal approach is applicable. And question four, if we were to apply the portfolio revaluation approach, we agree with the proposed approach.
Just maybe the reason for the disagreement between you and Mike is that they both are right. I believe that some exposures are managed on a fair value basis and some are not managed on a fair value. It depends a lot on the case. So, and this year, maybe you should consider, I believe for the cases where I manage the exposure on a fair value basis, this model here works better. And the other model, when I manage an interest income, which is part significant part of the portfolio, maybe some flexibility on the cash flow head on IAS 39 would help. Because in this case, the problem with IAS 39, you have to identify each transaction, and macro hedge doesn't help either. So maybe you flexibilizing the concept of cash flow head, and this concept here of open portfolio basis would happen this second, let's say, tranches of hedging. So
I do agree that there is another side. As soon as you remove fair value exposure, you do bring in cash flow exposure from a risk manager's perspective.
Exactly.
So these are two sides of the coin.
Yeah.
I do agree.
Roger?
Well, I'd agree with that suggestion, and I was suggesting that if we take some constraints off either fair value hedging or cash flow hedging, then you may end up with getting nearer where you want to. I had a more philosophical point there, which is really, are we going beyond the boundaries of financial reporting here? So traditionally, the front end of the annual report talks about management's view of the future and the risks, and the back end accounts for things, transactions that already have occurred. They may not have been fully matured. the hedges are already in place, so we have to worry about accounting for those. But a lot of what we're trying to fair value is stuff which is, hasn't even happened yet, it's out in the future. And I'm really wondering whether we, you know, hopefully the conceptual framework will be fairly rigid about what should be within financial reporting and what should be in the front end of the annual report. And I'm worried that we're going across the boundary here.
Fair point, Roger. That's one of the biggest discussions we put in the DP on pipeline transactions. And
you're turning yourself off all the time.
One of the big areas which we discuss in the DP is that how far do we go with this, because pipeline and other things, it's difficult to argue whether they have a revaluation exposure under the conception.
Well, whilst the hedge, you may already have a hedge for a pipeline, and that's definitely happened, so you have to account for it. Be it immediately take it to income or defer it, but you have to account for
it. I think that's where Mike's and other things is the alternative side, where you look at a cash flow, possible cash flow application of this.
Okay, shall we move to the next question?
Question five deals with transfer pricing transactions, and the DP explores whether transfer pricing transactions could be used as a proxy for capturing the managed risk and the revaluation of this managed risk in managed portfolios. And the question five asks you whether you think that transfer pricing transactions would provide a good representation of the managed risk for the purposes of applying the portfolio revaluation approach. And to what extent do you think that risk transfer to the asset liability management department via transfer pricing is representative of the risk that exists in the managed portfolio?
Let me just think. The transfer pricing area, what we're looking at in this, is just as a practical expedient. Even if you do not have transfer pricing, doesn't mean you can't apply the model. When we were discussing this, one of the key things that the banks did put us to us is that to make this operational, we needed to have transfer pricing. So it's not a key part of how we're doing. It's purely the operational expedient that we're looking at. And technically, if you take out the entire TP, the model should be able to stand alone if we ever get to an exposure draft level. So from the point of view of operational simplicity as one of the points, that's the question we had. Have you all heard anything from the bank side where they think that the transfer pricing mechanism can be used to do what we are proposing?
Mike?
I would have said generally yes, but don't underestimate that occasionally people build incentives into transfer pricing which have got nothing to do with interest rate management. And those can be quite significant incentives if you're trying to attract deposits or whatever else it is you're trying to do at a particular point.
Yeah, that's my impression too. My answer here would be, should be.
So effectively...
What extent do you think that it should?
So, no, we do cover both, even the incentives and the fact that you're trying to drive behavior rather than risk management in the DP. So generally what I'm... the feedback I'm getting is that, yes, possibly, but with some very strong restrictions around what can be included and considered to be a faithful representation. I'm not even sure we, in the final exposure draft, whether we will have a section on transfer pricing, because that's a practical expedient, but we just wanted to get a feedback on what people thought this was.
Okay.
Okay.
Next question?
Yes. We have been discussing this question since the very beginning, I think, so it doesn't need much of an introduction. The discussion paper presents two scope alternatives. Basically, the scope alternative is what are the exposures that would be subject to the portfolio revaluation approach. All of the exposures arising from all of the managed open portfolios. This is the focus on dynamic risk management, or only those exposures that are arising from either sub-portfolios or a proportional part of portfolios that have been dynamically managed and for which risk mitigation has occurred. And this basically is question six. It asks you which scope alternative do you think is the best one, why or why not, and if you do not agree with either of these alternatives, what do you suggest and why?
This has already indeed been discussed quite extensively. So.
Yeah, the feedback is very clear.
Well, I was going to say, is the fundamental problem we're trying to eliminate? It's a mismatch. You're not going to eliminate a mismatch if you include things other than those which are mismatched.
Yeah, so you're not a limited scope.
Yeah.
It's a limited scope. Okay. Vijay, did you have a question?
Question seven deals with other risk. The portfolio revaluation approach is aimed to be applicable to other risk, not only to interest rate risk in banks. And the question asks you whether you think the portfolio revaluation approach should be available for dynamic risk management other than banks' dynamic risk management. Why and why not?
Can I just say, though, that and I was having this conversation with Stephen Huber earlier, I think there are certain insurance risks which don't seem to be caught either by the current hedging standard or indeed even be caught by the macro hedging proposal. And I think some sort of proposal on that would be useful.
Okay. And the last question deals with an alternative approach that the discussion paper explores, which is the portfolio revaluation approach through OCI. And in this approach, the net effect of the revaluation of the future cash flows and the changes in the fair value of the derivatives would go to OCI rather than P&L. The discussion paper also discusses some of the concerns that this alternative poses, such as that the measurement of derivatives would be broken, so it would not be fair value through profit and loss, which is the assumption that the discussion paper does. It would unbalance the gross presentation of internal derivatives because they would not longer net to zero in profit or loss. And the last concern, there is recycling from OCI to profit or loss would not happen, because the managed exposures might be sold or derivatives might be terminated. And the question for you is whether you think that an approach incorporating the use of OCI should be considered, why or why not? And if you think the use of OCI should be incorporated, then how could the conceptual and practical difficulties identified be overcome?
We think that whether it is appropriate to use OCI depends on which of the two objectives is emphasized. If the faithful representation of dynamic risk management is considered to be of high priority, the use of OCI is worthy of consideration, because we question if the proposed approach is expected to provide relevant information from the perspective of reporting financial performance. Considering that gains or losses to be recognized by the approach are unrealized. On the other hand, if reduction of the complexity is the priority, we think it's unnecessary to use OCI when applying the proposed approach.